Author and Stanford Longevity Center founding director Laura Carstensen is a guest on Experience Talks, a radio show in Los Angeles. Listen in as host Tim Carpenter asks Carstensen about her book, A Long, Bright Future.
Laura Carstensen, welcome to Experience Talks.
Thank you, Tim.
So, Laura, first off, what inspired you to write the book, A Long, Bright Future? Why now? Why did you write this book?
Most of my research career, I have been studying human behavior, specifically motivation and emotion and how they change over the lifetime, and publishing my research findings in psychology journals that are read mostly by other research psychologists. And a lot of what we were finding in our research looked pretty good. I mean, older people are doing better emotionally than younger people are, and so on and so forth. But as a citizen, I kept hearing all of this sort of national conversation about aging that was mostly about concern about older people. And then, you know, you watch television and you hear stories about older individuals, or individuals, I should say, younger individuals who don't want to grow old, who are trying to fight it. And I felt like something needed to be said about the bigger picture, and that I had something to contribute, I thought, to this conversation. And so I wrote a book that was aimed at reaching a broad, wide audience.
I'm interested. You've been doing this for a while. You've been working in aging. What first got you interested in that, especially to make it a career?
I tell people that I came to aging, and my interest in aging came about by accident. I was in an automobile accident when I was 21 years old, and I ended up in an orthopedic ward for several months. And orthopedic wards, as it turns out, have bimodal age distributions, young people from motor vehicle accidents and older people with broken hips. And so I was surrounded by older women and spent months of my life there listening to them, befriending them, having long conversations. And during that time, I took my first psychology course ever. And so I was thinking about behavioral processes surrounded by older women, and I couldn't help but begin to think or ask the question, how much of aging is biological and how much instead is really steered by the environment? And I've decided to, you know, I mean, this is the short version of a much longer story is
sure.
That I decided to really try to figure that out, and I'm still trying to do that today.
In the book is A Long, Bright Future. You say you want a revolution. What kind of revolution are you looking for, and why?
What I'd really like is to see the revolution that my generation, I'm a boomer, said that we were going to have decades ago. And that is that we were going to change the way we lived, that we were going to look long and hard at our values, and we were going to try to create a world that was more supportive of people. And then we got distracted. I believe we never really lived up to our original claims of what we were going to do. We started to raise families, pursue our own careers, and really left the kind of social structures and culture that, you know, was there when we were there alone. We need to change the way that we live. We doubled life expectancy in less than a century, but we're still living our lives according to the same social scripts and guideposts that evolved around lives half as long. So we need a revolution in culture. We need to seriously look at every aspect of life and ask the question, is this the way you would live if you're going to live twice as long as you thought you were going to live? And when we begin to ask those kinds of questions, we see that most aspects of our lives need to be changed.
One of the things that I found really interesting in the book in regards to that, too, is that you're not just looking at the point where we get old with this revolution. You advocate one thing in the book. You talk about not having full-time work until we're 40 years old. So you're talking about revamping life, not just aging. Can we pull that off, do you think?
Boy, we better pull that off, or we will have missed one of the greatest opportunities in the history of humankind. You know, again, doubling the years we have on this earth. You know, I started asking people, if you had, you know, an extra 20, 30 years, where would you put them? You know, if you could put them anywhere you want in life. And I got to tell you, nobody said, well, let's make really old age longer. and the life course is a social construction. We can put these extra years anywhere we want. And if we're really going to be serious about reconstructing life or life courses, then we should think about where these years should go. The early years, the middle years of life as we live them today, tend to be very high pressure, lots of stresses on families, on young couples, on workers. And because we have more time, we could stretch out life.
So you're talking about switching things around in addition to retooling what we do until we're 40, you also advocate working until we're 80. It's another fairly radical idea. Do you think that people will follow that advice? Is that already happening?
Well, I can tell you that when I sell that model to the Stanford undergraduates that I teach, they like it a lot. When I try to sell it to my age counterparts, it's a little harder to sell.
Because they're just tired because they've thrown their whole middle into working
too
long. Yeah,
because we have lived that life of the high, you know, everything packed into the middle. And to then say, well, let's do that even longer, doesn't, to a lot of people, sound very appealing. But again, if we just kind of, you know, zoom out a bit and think about how we should and could and will live lives that are very, very long, a couple things about that. We really can't afford to have more retirees than workers. I mean, those numbers just simply don't work. But second, to budgets, and really more important than budgets, is a kind of thinking about life where we say that we should have 20, 30, maybe 40 years of leisure without any real obligations, you know, just a kind of, you know, golden years, years of relaxing, and that that's something that people should have, and that it would be good for people, that it would be a great reward. And as a psychologist, there isn't anything about that that sounds psychologically healthy. You know, I think of Janis Joplin and the, you know, the line in the song, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." You know, people do well when they're engaged in worlds, when they're engaged in their families and their communities, and they're doing something productive and they're contributing. It doesn't have to be paid work, but when they're part of something. And we have an opportunity now to really have people be a part of something well into their 80s and often into their 90s and above. So that's a really good thing. What we do need to do is to say, how do we fix this problem of having everything packed in the middle and having work be so onerous and so pressured that people want to get out of it? We need to address those kinds of jobs, and we need to make them different. We need to allow people to change jobs if they're, you know, just feeling like a grind. So there's a lot of work to be done in the area of work so that people feel like it's a piece of their lives that they embrace and that they value.
The research that started you thinking in this direction, the statement that older people are happier by and large than younger people, I know that a lot of people have fairly publicly said you can't possibly think that's true. I think Matt Lauer on the Today Show mm-hmm. might have been one of them. Mm-hmm. Why do people not believe that? Why do we not believe that that's possible?
Well, one reason I think we don't believe it is because we live in an incredibly age-segregated society. So very few people, younger people, know a wide range of older people. So we tend to have very small numbers on which we base our views of older adults. And so, you know, if your particular Aunt Betty had dementia, then you say, oh, my gosh, older people, you know, they do terribly, you know, and so on. But you don't see the broader picture and the heterogeneity. You don't keep in mind also those Supreme Court justices and those community leaders and so on who are also older. And so that's part of it. I think part of it also is that for a long time, even researchers turned to nursing homes when they were going to study old people. So you say, well, what are old people like? You know, you say, well, let me see, what are people who live in nursing homes like? Well, 5% of older people live in nursing homes. 95% don't. But I think there's a vividness to the very frail and firm elders, and that kind of overrides our picture of older adults altogether. Older adults who are doing well are often largely invisible, is the bottom line.
This idea of aging has become a fairly hot topic of late. What do you think has changed that makes people want to pay attention to this now?
The numbers. I think it's real, real simple. It's the numbers. I mean, people should have been thinking about aging a long time ago because humans grow old. You know, most of us will reach this period in time. But I think there's so much denial, both at the individual level and at the societal level, that people hadn't paid much attention. We're now living at a point in history where we just simply can't ignore the numbers. And so we have to think about old age, and we have to think about ways to make old age a really positive time. Because if it isn't, then we all, that is, we all being people of any all ages, will suffer. So we're at a point where we can't just ignore it anymore.
You mentioned the idea of affording the longer years, and obviously people talk in horror about what might happen with Medicare and Social Security. Is that as big a problem as we think, and are there other pitfalls to adding all of these years to the end of our life?
Well, Medicare and Social Security are in real financial trouble, and I don't think anybody who takes a serious look at the numbers can really honestly tell you otherwise. That said, we can fix these problems, these challenges. Social Security is relatively easy. If people work longer, we'll save the Social Security system and we'll be able to count on it, and our children and grandchildren will be able to count on it many years into the future. And it's not like people have to work 20 years longer. If people worked 5 years longer, we would save the Social Security system. So that one is pretty easy. And let me just add, there'll be people who can't work 5 years longer and shouldn't, you know, that they're sick or they're vulnerable or the jobs are so awful they shouldn't. But actually, that's a relatively small number. And so we could develop a system where those people can retire at 65 if they really choose to, but there'd be lots of incentives not to. That would be one possible general approach to saving the Social Security system as we know it. Medicare is another enormous problem, or is a more enormous problem, bigger problem to solve. But again, I believe that it's solvable. I believe that the Medicare system is so difficult to solve because it's systemic. It's not the responsibility or the of any one group that's at the table, the hospitals, the doctors, the insurance companies. It's a whole system that has, it was built within it, no incentives to be reasonable about cost. And that needs some serious work, and but it is, you know, it's a constructed system, and we can rebuild it.
We can deconstruct it. Yeah. Laura Carstensen, I want to thank you so much for being on Experience Talks, and congratulations on a terrific book.
Thank you, Tim. Pleasure to talk with you.